episode 610 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Marvel Monday episode, and apologies for it coming out a lot later than usual, hoping that it's going to be out by the weekend of the 1st, 2nd of December. It was supposed to be out on Monday, November 26th, but I have Thanksgiving house guests that stayed a lot longer than I was aware they were going to stay, and I don't in this house have a dedicated recording studio like I did at the old house, so it makes recording a challenge. I am on call this weekend for the day job, so hopefully it's not too terribly busy and I'll get a chance to do some post-production and sound editing, all the stuff I have to do before I put an episode up, and get it out to you guys sooner than later. So again, apologies. Appreciate you sticking with me. I think I'm about 5 episodes behind, just episodes that I missed. And I didn't necessarily go back when I did have a chance to record and record the episodes that I missed. I preferred to, if I had a night that I was able to record, I preferred to get the next day's episode recorded. Like, I made a huge effort to get New Comic Wednesday out on time, because I know there's several listeners out there who kind of rely on it to make sure they don't miss anything that's coming out that day. So I wanted to be sure to have that out on time. And I'm hoping to have the Justice League episode out, the Friday Justice League spotlight out on time as well, just because the Drowner storyline has already actually finished up. And so I want to be timely and get that out. So the Marvel Monday episode, you know, it's books that came out the previous week, and I don't worry too much about spoilers. So if this is coming out a little later than usual, you know, it's not terribly, you know, like if you were going to buy these books, you already bought them, right? So the fact that it's late, doesn't affect it too much, I hope. And then I think the other episodes I missed, I did miss Uncanny X-Men issue 2, which I really need to get that one. It's already recorded, but I just need to get it edited and out. Definitely want to do that because issue 3 has already dropped. So issue 3 will be in the December 4th episode. So that'll come out on time, the December 4th episode. So I certainly want issue or episode that covers number 2 out before number 3. So I'll definitely have to get that one up. And then I think the other two that I missed are kind of evergreen. And by that, I mean, they're books from way back. The Top Cow Thursday episode about the Devil's Reign, you know, that's, far in the past, and then need to still record the, Thanos Rising issue 3. So, Nick's been joining me for those, and, scheduling with him has been a challenge lately. So hopefully we'll be able to get that recorded and out on time this coming Saturday. But again, apologies for things being late. We will get caught up, I promise you. And, definitely have the house a little more manageable now, a lot more quiet. So, I'm able to record things, going forward. Everybody should be cleared out and gone, by Friday morning, by tomorrow morning. So hopefully we won't have any further issues. I really do like to work ahead if at all possible, but you know, with the day job, it doesn't always work out that way. And then with holidays and cooking all the food for Thanksgiving, obviously that becomes a challenge as well. And then, you know, just having a quiet place to record. So, you know, I have had people ask me if I consider doing Patreon, and I go back and forth on it. Like, I like to do this. I want it to be free. And, not to say I wouldn't begrudge people if they wanted to, you know, help financially support it. I mean, it would be nice to get big enough that this, podcast was producing enough revenue that I could go and rent, a recording space, right? Rent a little office space. That would be spectacular. But I don't know. I just don't really see that happening, anytime soon. But, the best thing you can do if you want the content to come out on time, I'm going to do my best, but tell your friends about us, right? I mean, the more the numbers go up, the more I can take those numbers to publishers and show them, hey, look at all how big my audience is, and it gets me more access, exclusives, you know, I get to have bigger and better creators on and get to do my thing that I do. And so always appreciate everything you guys do. All you listeners reaching out and talking to me on Twitter and social media and enjoying all the content I put out. So thank you all for that. But if I could ask for anything at all, rather than asking for financial support and Patreon or anything like that, I much rather would just ask you guys, hey, it's free for you to tell all your comic reading friends, and hopefully we all know at least a few other people that read comics, but let them know that this podcast exists. You know, it's been a really great year. Numbers have been going up steadily all year long, and it's been a whole lot of fun, and I really appreciate all that you guys do. So let's go ahead and dive into Marvel Monday. There's quite a few books I want to talk about today, so I may not go as in-depth. You know, I may not do the panel by panel or page by page recap of these issues that I normally do for a few reasons. I am trying to cover, let's see, 5 books this time, so it's a little more than I usually do, 3, maybe 4. And also, yeah, I'm behind, right? So I don't want to sell you guys short and not cover it in a way that like I usually do, but I also want to get it done, get it recorded, and get it out there for all of you people to listen to. And the other part is a couple of these books, one of them I didn't really care for, and I, in general terms, I don't like talking about books just to bash them. And I don't think that I do that. I think when I don't like something, I have, you know, valid logical reasons why it didn't work for me. Doesn't mean it's not going to work for anybody, right? Like there may be other people that read it and absolutely love it. It might be the characters didn't resonate with me. It might not be my style of story. I mean, there's a lot of reasons. But the fact of the matter is there are so many great comics out there. Like there's more comics than I have time to read. There's certainly more comics than I have time to talk about on the podcast. And so I always think, okay, so why do I want to waste time talking negatively about something when I can instead fill that podcast time with talking about something that's good? And I understand that once in a while you do need to talk about something negative for a couple reasons. First of all, you don't want to sound like you absolutely love everything and every comic ever made and ever produced is great, because then you don't have any credibility, right? And people just say, oh, he's just out there recording podcasts and saying everything's good because he wants to kiss the publisher's butts and get free books or whatever, right? Like whatever reason people might think. So there is that. I do want to be objective. I do want to give my honest opinion, and I think that I do. But again, nobody sets out to make a bad comic. And so I don't want to bash something just for the sake of bashing it. So I always try to keep that in mind, the fact that these people that are creating these books, they don't set out to do a bad job. They're trying to do their best. They want it to be good. They want it to succeed. Nobody gets into comics to be rich. So if you're working in comics, it's because you love comics. You really have to love what you do. And also they're people, right? I mean, we all make mistakes. That doesn't mean I want to pay $4 for a bad comic or $5 or whatever, but again, I try to be objective, take it with a grain of salt. If something didn't work, try to understand why it didn't work. And I know that a lot of creators don't necessarily listen to podcasts or even read their own reviews or press, because they think, well, you're never as good as your worst review and you're never as good as your best review. So it's kind of just dial that all down, drown that all out, and just do the best you can and don't worry about what the reaction is. And you can do that to some extent, but at the same time, you also want to know, is this resonating with readers? And so there's that aspect of it as well. But I always feel like when I don't like something, I know the reasons, or I try to know the reasons and understand the reasons why it didn't work for me. And if a reader or a creator rather does listen to one of my reviews, I want there to be something constructive for them where they can say, oh, it didn't work for him because of XYZ, and I understand that. Or it can be, well, it didn't work for him because of XYZ, but XYZ is my reason for doing the story, and he's just not my target audience, which is perfectly fine, right? Like, no, one comic is made for every demographic and every culture. Just like no TV shows or movie is going to reach every audience, right? Like we all have different taste and preferences and things like that. So anyway, that's part of the reason why some of these books I'm not going to talk about too in-depth. And the first book I'm going to talk about, I'm not going to talk about too in-depth just because this is the first issue of the series that I'm reading, and it's the last issue of the series. So I had heard a lot of people talking about it. It's Astonishing X-Men. It's number 17, Havoc on the cover, written by Matthew Rosenberg, pencils by Greg Land, inks by Jay Leistein, colors by Frank Darmada, letters by Clayton Cowles. And we've got a cover by Greg Land, Jay Leistein, and Frank Darmada, and an Uncanny X-Men variant cover by Alex Ross. So I had mentioned when I covered Uncanny X-Men number one, I wondered where Havoc was. He was kind of conspicuous in his absence. So I was like, okay, Havoc is over in Astonishing X-Men. Let's pick up Astonishing X-Men number one, or number 17, the final issue, and find out, like, is there a particular reason why we're not seeing Havoc in Uncanny X-Men? And part of the reason that I wanted to know is because Havoc's one of my favorite X-Men, and for no other reason than I just love the way he looks visually. And I thought that I had a good idea of who he was as a character, but after reading Uncanny X-Men 17, I realized I haven't really read much of Havoc in the past, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, so to speak. And so for that reason, I feel like maybe with the way he acts in this issue, maybe I don't really understand who Havoc is. And so I really do need to fill in my X-Men gaps and my Havoc history. Maybe that would be a great weekly podcast to do, right? Havoc history, and just go through and read a bunch of Havoc stories. But anyway, before I get into this particular story itself, I first want to talk about the art. Some people don't care for Greg Land's art. He's been accused of using a lot of photo reference, like to the point where he doesn't draw anything without photo reference, and he just goes around and finds photos and then basically kind of mimics them. I don't know how much of that's true, how much is not true. What I do know is I think that he does have a good sense of style. He might not have the best transitions from panel to panel. They do tend to be a little bit choppy, but you don't get lost. It's still, I think, good storytelling. And I think that his art is beautiful to look at. And I think it's very emotional. And I have no problem with Greg Land as an artist. I think I like his art. Does he have room to improve in kind of his transitions? 100%. That is the weakest part of his art for me. But again, I have absolutely no problem picking up a Greg Land book. I think in terms of style and line work and rendering, his art is very beautiful and also pretty traditional superhero art. I don't think he's necessarily the fastest, but again, I love Greg Land's art. I think it looks beautiful. A lot of big panels, a lot of cinematic shots, and it works based on what he, like the emotion and the impact that his style and his line work come across on the page, right? It using these kind of larger panels, splash pages, whatever you want to call them, it does help to have his art land with more impact. So in this particular story, the X-Men, the Astonishing X-Men, and again, this team isn't even necessarily called, like, Alex Summers is calling them X-Men, and Kitty Pryde is, like, not happy that he's calling them X-Men. So it's Havoc, it's Beast, it's Warpath, James Proudstar Warpath, it's Dazzler, and it's Colossus, and it's kind of the group of misfits in a way. And if you do pick up this issue, be sure and read the essay by Matthew Rosenberg in the back, because it talks about why he picked these particular X-Men or these particular characters to be in this book. And It's a really heartfelt and interesting story to read about. So in the little blurb previously in Uncanny X-Men, we see that Alex had previously been forced to become a villain, which is a whole nother. And I was reading this issue and I was like, wait, I thought I knew who Havok was, but he's much a little more lighthearted and less serious than I remember him being. Did that happen after his forced inversion from hero to villain? And then he got quote unquote cured. And then that made him a bit more devil may care, if you will, or was he always like that? Again, I was questioning my own knowledge of Havok. So anyway, Havok's teammates were captured by a federal agency known as One, and Havok and Warpath turn to the Reavers. Those are the cyborg X-Men villains, the ones we saw in the first part of the Return of Wolverine series. But they needed help. Havok and Warpath needed help. I don't know why they went to the Reavers rather than the other X-Men to help break them out. But once they did, the leader of the Reavers, Donald Pierce, commandeered the One's mutant hunting machine, Sentinels. We all know Sentinels if we're X-Men fans. And supposedly they killed the Astonishing X-Men. So that was the end of part four, right? Like cliffhanger. Spoilers. At the beginning of this issue, we see that the Reavers, having taken control of these Sentinels, again, they're cyborgs, so they're interfacing with them. They believe they've killed the X-Men. They look down on their bodies and say, hey, we did a good job, and they fly off. What we find, and this is super cool, of Matthew Rosenberg, I'm surprised no one has used Dazzler's powers like this before. What we find out is that she made these like hard light versions of the X-Men and basically tricked the Reavers into thinking that they'd killed the X-Men. The reason it worked, it wouldn't work against regular Sentinels, right? Just normal non-Reaver controlled Sentinels. But being that the Reavers have never been in control of Sentinels before, they've never interfaced with these Sentinels before, they don't understand how to use all their sensors and mutant tracking things and all that kind of stuff. So the Astonishing X-Men gambled on that working and being able to trick the Reavers, and indeed it did. So now that everyone is safe, Havok's like, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I'm going to go get a drink. And Dazzler's like, what do you mean? You're breaking up the team? And Alex is like, we weren't really a team. We're more of a slow motion train wreck with a light show. I put you guys all in trouble. I'm a terrible leader, but I did rescue you all. So I'm going to call it a day. And Colossus is not happy about that. He's like, wait, you're throwing in the towel? He's like, what do you mean? I got you guys out and that's it. And Colossus is like, no, there's still work to be done. And Beast agrees with Colossus. He's like, yeah, we can't let those Reavers just take the Sentinels and go do whatever they want to do. And Alex is like, that's the government's mess, man. They can clean it up. And Beast is like, yeah, about that, this map here on the wall is showing where the Reavers are going. And Alex is like, and I'm looking at this, why? And Beast's response is, because this is where the X-Men are. So the Sentinels immediately headed to the Xavier Institute in Central Park, and they're attacking. So as Kitty Pryde calls out for assistance, any available X-Men show up at the mansion now. Alex Summers says, you rang? And Kitty's like, you're not even supposed to be calling yourself X-Men. And Scott and Alex is like, we'll see. And the battle's on. So I'm not going to go beat by beat in the battle. There's a lot of really cool moments. There's a Sentinel getting his hand chopped off by Havok and then grabbing a like an 18-wheeler and pulling like some kind of a metal incorporation. I mean, he picks up the 18-wheeler, sticks it where his hand got severed off, and the truck basically, you know, he reforms the structure of the truck into becoming a new hand. It's really, really cool. We also get to see Banshee have a couple cool moments. But the bottom line is, eventually the X-Men, with the help of a lot of Dazzler, which she did some really cool stuff between the hard light stuff and her letting Banshee scream at her with the absolute limits of his power, and then absorbing incredible amounts of sound from Banshee and then firing it at the Sentinels. Really, really cool moments for Dazzler. Really shows her, shows just how powerful she can be. So once the X-Men win, Alex kind of has a heart-to-heart with Dazzler, and he's like, man, I really think we got to end this catastrophe. I'm not meant to be a leader. I'm not meant to be to have a team under my wing. It's just, I can't do that. So the fact of the matter is that this team that he put together, they're still fugitives. They did break out of a government facility. And so it's time for Colossus, Havoc, Dazzler, and Beast to kind of hit the road. They can't be caught on the school grounds. It would just be, the consequences would be too great for the Xavier Institute. So they all take off. Meanwhile, the head of One, General Robert Callahan, shows up to take away the wreckage of the Sentinels. And he's pretty much a jerk, and he's getting in Kitty's face about he can do whatever he wants, because even though this is private property, this is all stolen government equipment, and he believes that Kitty is harboring those fugitives there. I mean, he has every reason to think that, I mean, the last time they saw the Sentinels, they were in the presence of the Astonishing X-Men, Alex and his team. So if the Sentinels are here, it stands to reason that Alex and his team would be here as well. And again, this is all happening as Alex and his team are leaving in a Blackbird. And as they fly over, they see that Alex is, in fact, engaged with the soldiers of One. And Colossus is like, wait, Alex, you're in the plane with us getting out of Dodge. How can you be down there? How can you be in two places at once? And as he looks back, we see that the Alex that got onto the Blackbird is actually another hard light construction from Dazzler. And Beast is like, what did you do? And Dazzler said, you said it yourself, Hank. If we were caught, it would be disastrous. And Alex knew you wouldn't leave him if he did his big hero thing, and this was the only way for all of us to walk away. And Beast says, almost all of us, damn it, Allison. And he's clearly not happy. So Beast being a fugitive, I mean, that's, you know, Colossus, Dazzler, you can kind of see it, you know, but Beast, he's central part of the team. So maybe they just have to leave for a little while and they can come back. Where are we going to see the consequences of what Alex did? Maybe the Uncanny series, I'm not sure. But meanwhile, once back on the ground, once Alex sees that the rest of his team has managed to escape, he gives up. And he says, how about we make a deal? Admit it was just me and the Reavers that attacked your base and leave the X-Men alone. And in exchange, I'll surrender peacefully. And I won't release all the tapes I made of your illegal experiments on mutants. The fact that you had kidnapped them and you were killing Reavers and the attack that you led that destroyed an apartment block downtown. And Callahan's like, that's it. I get you right now. And Alex says, yep, that's it. But if you ever go after me or the X-Men or any of us again, I promise your face is going to be on the front page of every newspaper in the country. And Cal can't wait to make that deal. He's like, yes, deal, cuff him. And Kitty gets a chance to walk over and talk to Alex. And he's like, Alex, if you really have those tapes, why don't you just use them to clear your name? And Alex is like, yeah, I might have been bluffing about that. And finally, Kitty's willing to let him call himself an X-Men. As he gets carted off, she says, don't worry, Alex, we'll get you out. The X-Men don't abandon their own. And as he's being led away, Alex says, I knew you'd eventually admit we were X-Men. So it's an interesting dilemma that Alex finds himself in. We now know why he wasn't in the pages of Uncanny X-Men. James Proudstar, at least, is hooked back up with the X-Men. He doesn't seem to have a team anymore. He wasn't one of the ones captured, so he's not considered a fugitive for having escaped. Just Beast, Dazzler, and Colossus. And then obviously Alex Summers, because he led the attack. And I suppose they could have gone after Warpath as well, But we see that Alex really fell on his sword, so to speak. So what happens to Alex from here? When will he show back up? Again, I imagine the pages of Uncanny X-Men at some point, we should see him show up. And based on what I'm hearing about the future of the X-Men corner of the Marvel Universe, seems like there might be a lot of changes coming up soon. So hopefully we see Havoc back in the pages of some X-Men comics sooner than later, because he really is one of my favorite characters. And even though he seemed quite a bit different to me than I remember him here, I still loved how he was. I think that Matthew Rosenberg gives him a really, really great voice. So between that and the great artwork from Greg Land and great colors from Frank DiAmata, yeah, I thought it was a really great issue. Really glad that I picked it up. Really glad people were talking about it. And a lot of it was about the ending, which, you know, turns out to be Havoc being locked up. It's better than him being killed. That was what I was worried. I was like, oh man, don't tell me that Havoc bites the bullet at the end of that issue. I really hope that's not the case. So I'm glad that it was not that. So let me move on to the next book that I'm going to talk about in this episode. It's Immortal Hulk number 9 from writer Al Ewing. There's a couple of different artists on here because we have the book kind of separated into different pages, if you will. We've got Martin Simmons doing pencils, inks, and colors on the Creel pages. Creel as in Crusher Creel, the Absorbing Man. And then we have the regular series artist Joe Bennett handling the pencils for the Hulk pages with his regular collaborative team of Ree Husse on inks, Paul Mounts on colors, and VC's Corey Petit letters et al. We've got the regular Alex Ross cover. We've also got a variant cover from Arthur Adams and Edward Delgado. So when we last saw the Hulk, he had recovered from his being chopped up and placed into specimen jars and being taken to the Shadow Base. So this issue actually starts with a flashback 1 month ago, and we see Iron Man capturing Crusher Creel. And I have to say, Joe Bennett art, Paul Mounts art, Ree Husse art, as great as ever. The Martin Simmons art, it's a little less clean. It's a little more of a sketchy style. Like, I don't know if this guy ever draws a straight line. I mean, I think it's supposed to be this way. It's a little more emotional. It's a little more impressionistic. And I don't care for it. It's such a sharp contrast between his style of art versus Joe Bennett, where the lines are very thick and well-defined and delineated. And I don't know, I just prefer that. I don't think these two art styles go together at all. I think they're very incongruous. So Creel has been captured. We turn the next page. We're at now, and apparently Bruce Banner has been belly shot by a shotgun. He was trying to steal some clothes, as we've seen him do many times, off a washing line. And in the distance, we see the sun is setting with Banner saying, I'm sorry. And the guy that shot him saying, yeah, you are. Wait, damn. And we see him change into the Hulk quickly as his hand starts to turn green. Meanwhile, flashback to 1 month ago, we're back to Creel. He's being beaten up by some guardsmen, and they're trying to get him to give up his girlfriend Titania, but he doesn't even answer. He seems like he's willing to take the punishment to not turn over his girlfriend. Meanwhile, back to now, the man who shot Bruce Banner is being visited by what looks to be some kind of a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent or secret agent. You know, it's the typical black suit, white shirt, black tie. And once he determines that it was the Hulk, he says, wow, he let you live, huh? Thanks again. And the guy's like, huh? As the agent pulls out his hand, makes a fist, a gun with his fist, like not like you and I would, right? Like we'd curl the last three fingers, our index finger would be pointing straight ahead. The thumb is up like the hammer cocked, right? That's how we make a gun. This guy's hand looks like it literally morphs into a gun. And he shoots the guy, shoots the civilian as he calls in to Shadow Base saying, "This is Agent Burbank. The line is secure." He tells them what he found after piggybacking onto the 911 call, and the Hulk sighting is confirmed, and his sensors show a gamma trail leading in a particular direction. Seems like Red Dog is going to know where the Hulk is going. He's going home to New Mexico, to the place where he first became the Hulk. Meanwhile, it's 2 weeks ago now as time moves forward, and Creel is being offered the chance to not rot in prison. Switch back to the next page with Hulk feeling the pull, as he says, of getting home, and it's where he's strongest. And we're now at 11 days ago with the Creel story, and they're offering him a chance to get revenge on Hulk. And he's like, "I'm not stupid. Like, why would I want to go up against a guy who's pulverizing me and I've never come close to beating in a fight?" And General 14 says, "Let's not pretend you've mellowed and your pride is still hurting." He's clearly manipulating Creel. He's like, "Your pride is still hurting. And plus, you want to be stronger. We can make you stronger." Meanwhile, the Hulk is trying to understand why he came there to his home. And his thinking is that he needs to get whatever he absorbed from Walter Lankowski out of him. And for that, he needs to be stronger. And the place where he's the strongest is the place where he was born. And so he's hoping that he can force out whatever it is that has infected him and smash it. At least that's his plan. And he believes he's there of his own free will and he's not being manipulated, but that may or may not be the case. Meanwhile, we flash back to 10 days ago and we see Creel being injected with something that is supposed to give him a chance to go toe to toe with the Hulk. And despite his reservations, he goes through with it because, to quote General 14, he doesn't want to go back in his cell and rot. Meanwhile, present day, Hulk is starting to realize that he's been manipulated. He thinks it was you. It was you who put in our head the whole idea of coming here because this is your ground too, your place of power. This isn't where I get rid of you. This is where you get rid of me. And once Hulk realizes that, he's like, "Man, get out of my head and fight." He's clearly very upset. We're now at 5 days ago, and Creel has been boosted up. He now has very reddish skin. And in order to test his powers, if he's possibly able to absorb gamma radiation now, they let him hold a little pet mouse. And he does indeed absorb the radiation to the point that all that's left of the mouse is a little bit of red smoke and a skeleton. So meanwhile, the Hulk is trying to calm down, not get too mad, because that's exactly what this entity inside him wants him to do. He needs to figure it out. He needs to stay in control, and he's got to find a way to get rid of this whatever, this foreign object in his body. And as he's thinking, we see Creel dropping in from above, and Hulk's like, "What's that sound?" Because I'm sure they dropped Creel from probably a mile up. And we flash back to 20 minutes ago, right before Creel was deployed. He's in his cell, and he's starting to have some second thoughts, but it's a little too late now. He's looking at a picture of Titania, thinking pride before a fall. And General 14 asks, "What are you mumbling about, Creel?" He's like, "Nothing much. Just wondering how I got myself into this mess is all. And how maybe it was better to be some man in jail than some kind of red freak. Pride, huh? It's a killer." And 14 responds, "It is, and so is the Hulk. And according to security footage, he murdered Jeffrey Clive yesterday morning. Absorbed him, in fact, which we know to not be the truth. He was shot by that agent." So they go ahead and deploy Creel, and it's pretty much a knockdown, drag-out fight between him and the Hulk. And despite the fact that the Hulk has beat Creel many, many a time, we find out that whatever General 14 and his scientists did, it's going to make a difference. It seems like the ability to absorb gamma radiation that Creel has is really going to tip the scales, because every time Hulk punches him, he loses some of his gamma power. Like if he punches them with one hand, all of a sudden that hand starts reverting back to normal and looks very weak and emaciated. And the Hulk looks like he's literally disintegrating because of what Creel's power is able to do to him. And so he ends up kicking Creel and dazing him. And the Hulk is worried. He's like, what's Creel doing? Like, he sounds dazed. He sounds confused. And as Creel is laying there dazed, the Hulk catches a glimpse of his reflection in some broken glass, and he realizes that he is seeing himself again, as opposed to the reflection that he was seeing, where it was that entity inside of him he would always see staring back at him, the entity that kind of took the form of his father. And Hulk immediately realizes, wait, I got that thing into me when I drained Lankowski's gamma energy, and now Creel's drained mine. And we see the Hulk is clearly not at full power, but he's like, oh, here we go, round two, because Creel is somewhere else. The mask has been pulled away, and that entity, whatever it is, has taken root in Creel, but it doesn't seem content to just stay inside him. It immediately hatches. And we see this incredible art from Joe Bennett. It's really gory and bloody, and completely images like this completely give you the feel that this is definitely a horror book that that Joe Bennett is kind of helming the ship on, right? Like we talked about Man or Monster and how that question is the one that he's attempting to answer, and we may never get an answer, or at least not the answer that we expect. But bringing the Hulk back to those horror roots, the suspense, the thriller, the monster aspect of it, the Hulk coming out at night, and an image like this where the absorbing man's upper body is literally split in two, and we start to see this entity, whatever it is, kind of hatch out of him. It's just a brutal, brutal image, and it's right above the credits for the particular issue, with the title The Sinners there in big, bold, white letters. So really creepy, really gross, really not sure where it's going to go from here. Is the Hulk going to be able to finally fight this monster, this infection, this whatever it is, like physically fight him? Or is it more psychological warfare, rather? God, I can't talk tonight. And what about the absorbing man? How could he possibly survive this? Because the look on his face makes it seem like it wasn't very pleasant to be ripped apart from the inside. Not that we think it would. So great issue. I've said many times on the podcast since the first issue of Immortal Hulk came out that it's the best comic that Marvel's putting out. Without question, Immortal Hulk is absolutely spectacular, 100%. All right, next book I'm going to talk about from Marvel is the second issue of Marvel Knights. This is the Marvel Knights 20th anniversary miniseries. I think it's supposed to be 5 issues. The story is from Matthew Rosenberg and Donnie Cates. The script is Matthew Rosenberg. The art is by Nico Henrichon. Letters by Corey Petit, and I'm assuming Nico handles the color work as well, because there's no colorist listed. So not sure how, but we did learn last issue that somehow Dr. Doom has managed to recreate the world and make all the superheroes forget that they were superheroes. He's got Kingpin as kind of a sub-lieutenant running things, bowing down before Dr. Doom whenever Dr. Doom comes into his office. And what we learned in the first issue as well is that Bruce Banner is getting these letters from a child at night. He's assuming it's a child because it's like written in crayon. Words are misspelled. Letters are backwards. because whoever he turns into at night, whoever this person is that comes at night and leaves him messages, remembers everything, remembers the way things should be. So clearly it's the Hulk who's not affected by whatever Doom did, perhaps used sorcery would be my guess. And so Banner took a lot of those notes to Frank Castle, who is a police officer for the NYPD, and was able to convince him of the truth of it. And they in turn tried to recruit Daredevil, who did manage to gain his memories back, but didn't want to join up with Punisher and Bruce Banner, and is not, I mean, he remembers himself, but does he remember who they are? That's another story altogether. How did Doom do it and what happens next? So I think the first issue was scripted by Donny Cates. This one's by Matthew Rosenberg. They're co-writing it and probably taking turns scripting particular issues. So we see Daredevil accepting what has happened to him and realizing that he needs to take a more active role. We also get a flashback to 4 days ago when Banner first shows up and convinces Frank Castle, or the Punisher, to join up with him. And we see Frank and Bruce go after Electro Nachios to remind her that she is Elektra. And this is one thing that's really interesting. She's a character in this story that remembers her past, or thinks she remembers some of her past, and she remembers it not in a good way, right? How much she remembers being an assassin and killing innocent people, being a mercenary or a hired killer. And now she's got a martial arts studio that she owns that she's an instructor at, and her life is actually better. And she wouldn't want to go back to the other way that it was. So there's a knockdown, drag-out fight between her and Frank Castle, the Punisher, which the Punisher actually does better than I would expect that he would. I don't know. I mean, I never think of the Punisher as a really great hand-to-hand combatant, right? Whereas Elektra is one of the best hand-to-hand fighters in all of the Marvel Universe. So he's definitely stubborn, though, and he's not willing to give up. And despite all that, despite their fight, Banner turns into the Hulk in the back of the police car, and it looks like they may be willing to work together, because right as the Punisher is about to open the door, Nachos changes her mind. She looks like she's going to stab Frank in the back, but then her hand is knocked away by a billy club. And we see Daredevil there in full costume saying, let's all calm down now. And Frank Castle's like, you remember? And he says, I do. We've all got something in common. The life that I lived before, it got erased. We got to figure out who erased it and why. And I don't think we can do it unless the three of us work together. And Electro Nachios says, what about her? How does she fit in? And Daredevil says, wait, what do you mean? You can see her too? Because at the beginning of the issue, he was talking to Karen Page. And we saw that that was how the last issue ended, with him talking to Karen Page, who clearly is a touchstone, the love of Matt Murdock's life. And he believed her to be just a kind of a figment of his imagination, right? Like he's blind. It's not like he could actually see her. He was just hearing her. And is she actually there? Is he just hearing her voice? Is that truly the voice of Karen Page? Or is it just Matt's own self-conscious manifesting itself as him thinking he hears Karen's voice? But when Elektra says that she can see Karen Page, that really throws Matt for a loop. So I like the way that Matthew Rosenberg and Donny Cates are honoring Marvel Knights with this story. It's pretty interesting. I didn't necessarily care that much for the art in this particular issue. I thought the line work was okay, but not quite as clean as I like. And I thought the anatomy at times looks really strange and inconsistent. There are some times when Elektra's face looks like she's like a 12-year-old girl, and other times she looks more like a grown woman. So yeah, just really inconsistent. I really feel like, you know, we've talked a lot in the recent past about how DC was really doing a better job storytelling-wise than Marvel, and that gap has been closed substantially over the last year, 6 months to a year. But DC still has far and away the better quality artists. like some of the artists that work for Marvel, I'm just like, man, I cannot believe that they're allowed to work on monthly books for Marvel. I mean, I don't know. I have heard some rumblings that Marvel's page rates have not only have they not been going up, but they've actually gone down. So if that's the case, they're going to have a hard time getting good quality artists to work over there. I mean, why would you work there if you could work at DC and make, you know, 50 to 100% more per page? Freelance is not for the weak. You got to make your money while you can. There's no health benefits. There's no retirement. There's no sick pay, none of that stuff. So you've got to make your money while you can. You can't afford to sell yourself short. Anyway, that being said, it's not the worst art I've seen, but I would just think on a story like this, you know, Marvel Knights 20th anniversary, this is an important book. They put two of their biggest writers on it, Rosenberg and Cates. You would think they'd try to get a name artist on the title, you know, Mike Diodato or Aaron Cutter or somebody. Anyway, I am enjoying what the story has been like so far. I feel like it's been paced kind of slow, though. Like, we've already had two issues, and we still, you know, we did get a glimpse of Dr. Doom. Apparently he's the big bad, but I still feel like not that much has happened. It's felt a little bit like setup. So hopefully with issue three, the story's going to kick into high gear, so to speak. All right, next book I'm going to talk about for Marvel Monday is Iron Man, Tony Stark, Iron Man, number 6. This issue, Tony Stark releases Escape, or Escape. It's his virtual reality, massively multiplayer platform. And things, I'm just going to put it this way, things do not go the way Tony expects them to. The story is being written by Dan Slott. The script is by Jeremy Whitley and Dan Slott. The artist is Valerio Schite. Colors are by Edgardo Delgado, and letters are by Joe Caramagna. And the art is solid, not spectacular. Again, I wish Marvel could get better quality artists. It's not terrible art, but it's just, I mean, this is one of their flagship titles. It should have absolutely spectacular artists where the art just blows you away. And the art is serviceable at best, especially inside the Escape. And I don't know if Valerio was trying to really differentiate between the two, and that's why it looks kind of unfinished in a way. I suppose that's possible. But again, it shouldn't even be something that I notice, because there are times when the art is to the point where it pulls me out of the story. So anyway, this ties in with the overall story that Dan Slott has been telling since the beginning of Tony Stark Iron Man. I feel like Slott is a throwback writer in that way, that where he'll write issues or short story arcs that everything, all the loose ends are all tied up nice and neat. But if you look deeper, there are themes and other subplots that are running for a long time. That used to be how all comics were, right? Things like X-Men and Fantastic Four, you would see little hints of something, 6 months, maybe a year in advance, and it would eventually come to fruition as those narratives kind of grew organically. And it's kind of the same way that Slott is working. We did see the Controller and him having his clutches, his claws into Bethany Cabe, Tony Stark's head of security, and he's been manipulating her, and we're starting to see the fallout from that because, as I said, this launch day of Escape does not go the way that Tony needs it to go. The Escape is kind of taking on a mind of its own and hurting civilians and allowing incidents of abuse to happen in Escape. And this is like the biggest launch ever of any kind of platform or product from Stark Industries. So it definitely can cause issues. And clearly within the world of the Marvel Universe, it's a really popular platform and piece of technology, because it's to the point where shipments of these Escape consoles are being stolen. Like it's worth more per pound than gold or platinum. And we see Tony Stark and Wasp which that's an interesting relationship that Dan Slott has brought back. But we see them trying to stop a heist from these consoles from an 18-wheeler. So clearly it's making an impact. Clearly it's important. And if something is wrong with the system and people are going to get hurt and or killed, it's going to look really bad on Stark Industries. It's going to look really bad on both Tony Stark and Iron Man. So he's definitely racing the clock to get it fixed, but he doesn't even know what the problem is, and he's completely unaware that for whatever reason he's on the controller's radar, and the controller is looking to do what exactly? I'm not sure we know, other than just make Tony Stark's life a living hell. So really been enjoying Tony Stark Iron Man. Again, I you know, being an old school comic reader and having stories from Dan Slott where he has these subplots that eventually come to fruition. It's a nice old school sort of way of writing comics, and I for one really, really enjoy it, as opposed to having the entire issue just laser focused on one particular story. It's nice to have several balls in the air. And one of the other balls in the air that I'll mention as kind of a last point here is the relationship that Tony Stark has with his biological mother. Not sure how I feel about the fact that Brian Michael Bendis added that in, you know, Tony Stark having a different mother, different biological parents than we knew of, and also a long-lost brother, Arno Stark. It just feels like retroactive continuity for the sake of retroactive continuity. It doesn't feel necessary to me. But in all fairness to Bendis, I haven't read all that stuff, so I really couldn't speak to the quality of it. So, all right, next book I'm going to talk about is Web of Venom, Carnage Born, number one, from writer Donnie Cates, art by Danilo S. Bayruth, colors by Chris Peter, and letters by Clayton Cowles. Let me talk about the art first. Man, I really hated it. I thought it was absolutely horrible. There's panels where I can't even barely tell what's going on. In the panels where I can tell what's going on, it seems very amateurish and unfinished. The line work's not good. The anatomy's not good. I didn't think the storytelling was particularly good. It's choppy. And yeah, just amateurish, I think, is the best way I can put it. I can't believe this guy is allowed to illustrate a Marvel comic, you know. Again, like I said, I'm not trying to bash anybody. And there are some panels that are impactful. And the guy, there is some talent there. There's a few panels where I just go, oh, like, how come you don't draw that all to look like that? Like, that's got detail. That's got emotion. That's correct anatomy. But then you go to the next panel and it's all messed up again. So I think maybe it's just a matter of working on his craft to get it to where it needs to be, but I don't think it's there yet. Like I said, I'm sure that he did the best job that he could, but I just don't feel it's up to Marvel Comics standards. So again, not trying to beat up Danilo, but I just think there's a lot of room for improvement. And the colors, it's pretty muddy. I don't know if that's an aspect of the way the art is. That if I don't know enough about kind of the technical aspects of coloring to understand if subpar penciling makes it. I imagine it would make it a little tougher to color, but I still think there are things that could have been done better. Because it's very muted and it's very one note, and the colors don't do anything additive to the story. And I know that Chris Peter must have some coloring skills, because there is one particular page with like this fiery bird on it where the colors are done really, really well. So I know the talent is there. It just didn't come through in this book. As far as the story, Donnie Cates going back to his horror roots to tell the origin of Carnage, you know, offspring of Venom. And I haven't been reading the Venom title. I know that Cates has added some horror elements to that to the symbiote, and he's retconned in some previous appearances on Earth and all that stuff. And I don't know. To me, it's a bridge too far. I'm not a giant Venom fan, and I just think it's okay to just have Venom be Venom and just be the alien costume that Spider-Man brought back from Battleworld. I don't know that we need to get into these symbiote gods and all this this other, to me, unnecessary origins and motivations. And the Venom is killing dragons and taking on a dragon form, and it seems to be complicated and convoluted just for the sake of being complicated and convoluted. It's not compelling to me. It doesn't interest me. And so if that's your thing and you love Venom and you love symbiotes and you love horror and you love all that stuff, then great. You probably love this book because it's got all the aspects of horror that you'd want. You know, it's got the damaged central character of Cletus Cassidy, who it seems was doomed from the start, just based on the fact that he was born like in a mental hospital and his mom had all kinds of problems and she was a criminal. And, you know, he never really had a chance. So he is both terrifying and evil and tragic in a way. You've got this cult seem to worship the symbiotes and have a lot of knowledge, and they're rescuing Cletus from his most recent debacle where he was he was literally stranded in outer space. And then we've got evil like deities showing up, and we've got some gore and some people being eaten. Like it's a definitely a horror comic in the guise of a comic about Spider-Man and some of his supporting characters. So like I said earlier, I could take it or leave it, and I'm going to leave it. I picked it up because I wanted to see what the buzz was about. And Donny Cates is a really hot writer. I do kind of wonder how much my take on the story and my reaction to the story was influenced by the art, which I really, really don't like, and how much more interested I might have been in to read more of this story if the art was done by an artist that I really liked, or an artist that was at the top of his game. It may have really made a difference. Now, all that being said, I do love the final issue or the final page reveal on what is being asked of Carnage. He basically has to go after everybody who's ever worn a symbiote and take them out. So, yeah, that's a pretty tall order, and it should make for some interesting issues going forward. I would be interested in reading, right? Like Venom going after, or Carnage rather, going after everybody who's ever worn a symbiote. That could be interesting, but it's going to have to be from a different artist. I won't pick up a book that's from this artist again, and unless he does a heck of a lot of work to improve it. It's just not worth it for me. I have too many other books to read to pick up something where I struggle because of the art. All right, last book I'm going to talk about for this particular episode is Daredevil number 10, continuing our look at Charles Soule's Daredevil run. This is with regular series artist Ron Garney and regular color artist Matt Milla. We've got letters by Clayton Cowles, as I mentioned, written by Charles Soule, and this book came out in 2016. It's starting a new arc after the two-part Spider-Man story, Spider-Man team-up storyline, and it starts off with Daredevil on the Upper East Side letting a guy go, and it's really interesting. We get the inner dialogue, and Daredevil's talking about the fact that he doesn't get up to this neighborhood of Manhattan very often, so he's going to let this guy go so he can chase after him and kind of get the lay of the land, because who knows when this new flagpole hanging off of a building that he discovered, who knows when it may come into to use and be handy. So The other reason he let the guy go, he says, why take out one bad guy when you can take out four? As the guy that he let go runs back to his base, and Daredevil's able to take out both him and his whole crew. Meanwhile, 3 p.m. later that day, Manhattan District Attorney's office, Matt still has the office in the elevator shaft, and Sam, Blindspot, shows up. Remember, he had his arm broken by Elektra a little while back, and Daredevil told Sam to go to the DA's office, get a job from Matt Murdock, and that would help him out until he got back on his feet. And it's interesting, Daredevil knows that Sam is Blindspot, but that knowledge doesn't go both ways. And so Sam's there, he's just about to leave for the night, and says he just wanted to see if there was anything Matt needed before he left for the night. And Matt asks him if he has any big plans, and he immediately starts climbing up the walls of the elevator shaft, saying, well, I finally got the arm off, the cast off my arm, rather. I'm thinking about working out. It's been a while. And Matt knows exactly what he means. He means getting back to work as Blindspot. And Matt says, well, you know, take your time. As a blind guy, I've had my share of injuries, and I know it's important to give yourself time to heal. And by the way, just because I'm blind doesn't mean that I didn't know you were jumping around the elevator shaft, and it's here purely for decorative purposes. If you break your neck climbing around up there, it's on me. And Sam's response is, well, maybe I should be more careful, because now that I'm healed up, it's back to cleaning toilets at Columbia, which apparently was his previous job. And Matt says, what? Why? He's like, well, I thought this was just a temporary gig, right? Just until I got better. That's what Daredevil said. And Matt's thinking to himself, man, not only 2 months in and he's already the best legal assistant I've ever had, things may get a little complicated keeping an undocumented immigrant on the payroll to DA's office. But hey, you want to break the rules? Call a lawyer. I love that line. It's one that I think I've heard Charles Soule say in person before. And Matt goes on to say, well, Daredevil probably didn't want to commit me to anything permanent, but I think it's really worked out. I want you to stay. And Sam seems excited about the prospect, and goes ahead and tells Sam, yeah, you can go ahead and take off. I'm working the late shift tonight. And as Sam leaves, he's like, I don't get it. People talk about you like you're one of the best lawyers in the city. And around here, they treat you like you're brand new. You're, you know, handling the lowest of the low cases in night court. And Matt says, well, you know, I made a mistake when I first came on, and now I'm paying for it. But you get out of here, go do have your workout. Just take it easy. Don't push yourself too hard, too fast. And Sam says, I wonder what Daredevil would tell me to do. And Matt doesn't miss a beat and says, well, you aren't talking to Daredevil. So as Matt heads into night court, meets up with a couple of his colleagues, and finds out they have a more than full docket. And as they get to work in Chinatown later, Blindspot has his costume on for the first time and comes across a message that was left for him at like a prayer shrine, a Chinese prayer shrine. And as soon as he goes to the spot, he enters the building and then immediately exits saying, holy bleep, calls Daredevil, Matt, as we know. And he's like, wait, what's going on? He's like, I'm here and there's a dead body. I'm not sure what to do. And Matt's like, did you kill someone? Blindspot says, no, he was dead when I got here. He's like, okay, just call the cops. Give them a tip. It'll be fine. He's like, I don't think I can. I'm involved somehow. I was invited. Can't you just please come out here? And Matt relents and says, sure, I'll be there as soon as I can. Goes back into court, tells his legal assistant, hey, do whatever you have to do. You've got to get someone to cover my shift the rest of the night because I have a friend that got in an accident, and you're fully authorized to horse trade on my behalf. I'll take half their caseload, night shifts, whatever it takes. And he's really not happy about that because his legal assistant's like, man, pulling this sort of stuff is not going to win you too many friends around here. And Matt's like, yeah, I know that, you know, he's trying to get out of the doghouse, and here he is having to bail again. And that's exactly why I didn't want to be on night court in the first place, because it interferes with his ability to work as Daredevil. So he goes and meets up with Blindspot, And what they discover is there's indeed a dead guy there. His eyes have been removed. He's holding a paintbrush, and there's a mural on the wall that looks to be painted with blood. And Blindspot says, I don't think that this guy that's holding the paintbrush, who has been exsanguinated, like all his blood has been drained. He's like, I don't think he has enough blood in him for somebody to have painted this, right? Could anyone? And Daredevil says, well, you'd be surprised. And then asked Blindspot if he touched anything. He's like, no, of course not. Didn't get anywhere near it. And Daredevil says, well, good, because this is a crime scene. He's like, what, you're going to call the cops? And Daredevil says, of course, we have to. But maybe you just call it in like a tip, right? And just say, I tell them what you saw anonymously, and we'll be gone by this, you know, before they get here. And then he asks him, well, you said you're invited. What does that mean? And so Blindspot tells him about the shrine in his neighborhood where people leave him messages asking for help. And Daredevil's like, well, people knew about that. Like, it was common knowledge in the neighborhood, and someone's playing games, right? They lured you here and they wanted to show this off. And it might mean something, and it certainly is the beginning of something. But don't worry about the cops. We won't mention the invitation yet. Just call them and get them here. And Blindspot's like, okay, if that's what you want to do. Because if I ever mention the invitation, you know, it may lead them to finding out my secret identity, which causes all kinds of problems because I don't have papers, I don't have rights, undocumented immigrant. And Daredevil's like, what do you mean? Just because you're legal doesn't mean you don't have rights. The law. And Blindspot interrupts him, says, yeah, the law, right? Again, speaking from experience, speaking from someone who has lived as an undocumented immigrant in New York City for his whole life, basically. So Daredevil's like, let me go ahead and take the invitation. I can pass it along and say it was sent to me, okay, if necessary. And Blindspot's appreciative of that, and then says, so now what are you doing? I thought you said we couldn't touch anything, so this is a crime scene. And he's telling Daredevil that as Daredevil is running his hand over the mural. And he says, yeah, it is a crime scene. It's mine. And he goes on to say that everybody's blood smells different based on body chemistry and diet and background and all sorts of factors. And he's not good enough to identify one person by the scent of their blood, like Wolverine could, for example. But he is good enough to tell the scent of one person's blood from another. So he couldn't necessarily smell someone's blood and then smell this painting and say, okay, this blood goes to that person, this blood goes to that person, this blood goes to that person. But he is skilled enough to be able to determine how many different samples, how many different people's blood is on here. And he tells Blindspot, he's like, yeah, it's not just one person's blood. And Blindspot's like, wait, how many people are up there? And Daredevil says, well, I could be off by one or two, but by my count, at least 113. And we get to be continued. So clearly there's something going on that's been going on for a long, long time. And obviously, being that this is the first issue of the arc, it's a lot of setup. Trying to understand this new situation that Daredevil finds himself in, plus Charles Soule, just kind of like Dan Slott I was talking about with the subplots, coming back around to talking about that idea of undocumented immigrants. Which Charles Soule, for those of you who don't know, he's an immigration lawyer. So this is kind of firsthand knowledge for him, telling stories about immigrants. And so I love that subplot is coming back around. I love the whole dynamic of Matt struggling to do his job as a lawyer. You know, I always thought it was kind of strange that he was a vigilante by night that was going after criminals, but by day he was a criminal defense attorney. I always thought that him as a DA, as a prosecutor fighting for the side of the law or the side of the police or however you want to put it, the government, made more sense just thematically. So I love the fact that Soule has made that transition and Matt is working for the DA's office. But again, it's especially working night court, there's a lot of inherent problems in that. And there's always still the dilemma too, right? Like we saw it with one of my favorite DC series of all time, Vigilante, where someone you work in within the system is then taking the law into their own hands by being a costume vigilante at night. There's a bit of a conflict of interest. There's a bit of a moral quandary there. And I imagine that Charles Soule, being the skilled writer that he is, will eventually get to exploring that as well. But this is just incredible storytelling. Absolutely love Charles Soule's run on Daredevil. Came to an end very recently. Was sad to see it end because I think that he's the perfect writer for Daredevil. And I do hope that he returns to the character in the future. As far as the art goes, it's Ron Garney's style and the style that him and Soule chose for the book, because it's not a style that Garney always works in. It's a bit more stark, and then when you add in the limited color palette that Matt Milla gives to the book, it gives it a definite tone and feel of being very noirish, Sin City-ish, if you will, if you want to take that example of what it is. But it suits the story and the mood and the tone of what Charles is trying to do so well, because it feels very urban, it feels very street, it feels very gritty, it's dark in a way, it's a little messy. And you know, normally I like my art to be really clean, and this is certainly isn't my favorite style of art, and I think that the story could have worked just as well in a more traditional style. But I think that mood-wise and tone-wise, it's exactly what Ron and Charles set out to do, and it is very effective in this context. So we're going to continue to cover the Charles Soule Daredevil run, because I think it's absolutely spectacular. And when I heard that it was ending, I thought, this is a perfect time to go back, do a retrospective, and it also ensures that every Marvel Monday, we're talking about one book for sure that you can count on. You know, we're always going to be covering the next issue of Charles Soule's Daredevil. So like next Marvel Monday, we'll be talking about issue 11. So anyway, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please be sure to check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.